WIOX is supported by you and the following underwriters.
The Catskill Mountain Foundation, celebrating decades of arts on the mountaintop with countless performances, classes, and community events each year, from Grammy Award-winning music to dance and art classes for all ages, including classical music, April in Paris, a romantic conversation, and musical stroll through the City of Lights with musicologist Dr. Jeffrey Lanford and pianist Dr. Joanne Poole, Saturday, April 13th at 2 p.m. More information at CatskillMTN.org. They knew the Shop of Mother Earth, Peruvian Boutique, for clothing and hats, blankets and bags, rugs, pillows, and decorative pieces using sustainable organic materials. They knew the Shop of Mother Earth.
I want to tell you I love
777.
Rick's Tire Service, family-owned and operated on State Route 30 between Roxbury and Grand Gorge. Tires, mounting, and wheel balancing for cars, trucks, lawn, garden, farm, and construction vehicles. Open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, Saturday, 8 till noon. More information at 800-LG-TIRES, 800-LG-TIRES. This is WIOX Roxbury, your live and local soundtrack for winter in the Catskills. As you cruise through local towns and villages like Delhi, Davenport, Stamford, Hobart, for rare books, bright lights, meditative days, and karaoke nights. Find links to winter happenings in the Catskills at WIOXradio.org.
You are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org on computers or smartphones. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and Zane. Zane, how's it going?
Good, good.
What have you been up to?
Well, with the crappy weather we've been having, I've been in the office lately. But in those sort of days when it's not cloudy, I've been kind of out in the woods doing some cutting where I am, opening up some apple trees and pruning, and finishing up boiling sap. I think this might be my last week here in Margaretville. I've made almost 2 gallons and pretty happy with that. But I might leave a couple buckets left on the trees for next week, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think this time last week, I may have pulled my buckets. I'm in central Ulster County, and although I don't think it's going to make too much of a difference, but those lows at night are just staying above freezing. And my sap was going yellow anyway. You know, usually get 4 to 6 weeks no matter what.
Yeah.
And I tapped in mid-January, so I was pretty much done myself. I would say it was just an average to above average season. Sugar content was decent. Sap flow was strange. It was, you know, either too cold or too warm. But, you know, all in all, it ended better than I thought it would. But this year I was especially happy I tapped early, because otherwise, you know, if you had tapped last week or 2 weeks ago, I think it would have been too late. It's just, you know, who knows the future? You wouldn't know that you'd have days like today where it got up to 60 degrees.
Right.
So,
yeah. I tapped in January 20th, so. Some people told me that was a little too early, but this is my second year of doing it, so who knows? I've just been still experimenting, but the temperatures seemed to say it was okay, so I went, did it, and I'm pretty happy with what I got.
Yeah, thus far, I have had no, negative things from, results from tapping early. And I've tapped in January, I've tapped in February, I've tapped in March, and I haven't seen that yet. But who knows? But tonight's topic is forest management with birds in mind, with Audubon New York's Claire Mann. She is the Forest Program Senior Associate for the Audubon New York, and she works with forest owners and conservation groups to foster better bird habitat. Let me see if I can get her on. All right. Claire, are you there?
Yeah. Hi, Ryan. How's it going?
All right. It's going well. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
Yeah, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Geneseo, New York, which is like western edge of the Finger Lakes.
Yeah, wow. So what county is that?
Livingston County.
All right, Livingston County. What was the weather like there today?
It was rainy, but pretty warm.
Yeah, I think it got up, like I said, 60 degrees in Margaritaville.
Yeah.
You know,
warm.
So, well, first of all, before we get into the topic, like, what got you into, didn't you go to the State University of New York there, College of Environmental Science and Forestry, right?
Yes, I did, in Syracuse, New York. So I got a bachelor's degree from there in environmental biology, and really out of college, I started working in environmental education, and when I was living out in Idaho, I did some volunteering with the U.S. Forest Service and really kind of fell in love with the work that they did, and got my first seasonal position with them as a timber marker, and I've been just really into forest management ever since then. So it's really just what I'm pretty passionate about now.
I mean, that's quite the difference, huh? The northeastern forest from Idaho?
Yes, very different.
No kidding. So that makes three of us. Stumpies, ESF. Yep. What year were you again,
I graduated in 2016.
2016. Yeah. All right. So, and you graduated how long ago, Claire?
I graduated in 2015. So, Zane, I guess we would have been there at the same time.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Probably crossed paths in the quad there.
So how was Zane? Was he just a pain or awkward kind of guy?
I didn't need him there.
Oh, all right. So what are we talking about tonight? So what got you into forestry or you know, just wanting to work outside anyway?
So growing up, I spent a lot of time outside. My family makes maple syrup, and I used to spend the springs, you know, in the woods with my dad, chopping trees. And I think that really kind of inspired me to just want to spend my time outside. And so it's really great that I get to do this kind of work now.
So, like, when he was doing the sugaring, did you just, like once in a while go outside or ignore him? Because, you know, I'm trying to gauge this off my own kids. You know, they don't really seem that interested, but sometimes they are. You know, you can't tell. So, like, were you just, like, all into it or what?
When I was younger, we were definitely out all the time, but it usually was more me and my brothers playing in the woods, not necessarily helping with syrup. But as we got older, we were really involved and are still really involved.
All right. Well, that makes me feel a little better. So
yeah.
I mean, what do you expect them to do? Like, just watch the water boil away for hours?
So right. Growing up in a sugar bush, what inspired you to go to school? What did you go to school for that you learned from your upbringing?
So you know, like anyone who's just graduating high school, you know, you're trying to figure out what you want to do with your life, and that can be pretty challenging. And for me, I really had kind of no idea. I just knew that I wanted to be outside, and I was very into sciencey things. And for me, you know, it was kind of visiting SUNY ESF there in Syracuse that I really felt like that was a cool place that I would enjoy going to. And I did really like it. And, you know, I wish to some extent that I got into forestry sooner, but my degree is in environmental biology, which, you know, is a little bit different of a path into this career, but I think it all worked out. So,
what was it about forestry that you're like, yeah, I like that? Like, what was different from the culture of forestry from environmental biology?
You know, I really didn't know a lot about land management. You know, going to school, I thought, you know, most people maybe got into research of a particular issue or something like that. And then once I started working more in management, I was just really drawn to it because you get to think about all these different factors and you're thinking about how humans interact with all this stuff and how do we find that balance. And to me, it's just really interesting.
To me, that's a continuing theme in this show is that, yeah, for some reason, I feel like we teach kids to monitor wildlife and do research, but we don't teach them about habitat management. It's like the wildlife is kind of there, but we don't think about how they got there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and how they're using it, you know, at the same time as we are. How can we all coexist and still benefit from each other and take care of each other?
Yeah, I was a forest biology major, and the more I think about it, yeah, we never cross paths with the natural resource department with the kids from the ranger school, and we never really discussed land use as a factor in how we should study the woods. And,
that's what I was kind of alluding to. It's a cultural divide. I mean, if John were here, he has a wildlife background, and it's strange to think, right, that you would think you'd talk about more habitat management with wildlife, but it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It's more about monitoring for the most part. I'm not saying they do have probably some, but there's been that divide amongst wildlife management. You know, it's just monitor the mayhem but not do anything about it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's like exactly what our work focuses on, you know, is how do we take all this research and all this knowledge that we have and actually implement it into seeing change on the ground. So.
Well, I think that's great. So that's why we're having you on the radio show tonight, right? So this is forest management with birds in mind. And, yeah, let's get into that. But first of all, I mean, how would you describe Audubon for people who aren't familiar with this organization?
Yeah, so Audubon is a conservation nonprofit, and our mission is to protect birds in the places that they need today and tomorrow. And we work throughout, you know, North America and South America, do a lot of science, advocacy, education, and on-the-ground conservation. And it looks really different in all, you know, different parts of the country and North America and South America. But, you know, we really are focused on birds and their habitat, and we do a lot of education. And I think that's what a lot of people are familiar with. And then, you know, we're doing a lot of the on-the-ground conservation and taking that research and that knowledge that we have and implementing it to help out birds and make sure we're providing high quality habitat for them.
Hmm. You say something, Sam? You look like it.
Well, I'm just curious. You know, we're educators as well. What kind of tips and tricks that you've learned along the way as an educator to help with the general public?
Good question.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important to try to, you know, frame anything that you're talking to the public about in a way that they're going to understand. One, you know, if I'm talking to landowners, I'm not going to talk to them in the same way I would talk to a professional forester about forest management. Or if I'm talking to someone who isn't a landowner, isn't used to spending time in the woods, you know, I'm going to tailor whatever I'm talking about to them. And I think it's really also about finding stuff that people care about. And luckily for us, there are a lot of people that care a lot about birds. So it's an easy transition for us to get into. Well, if you care about birds, this is how you help them, and this is, you know, the management that we can implement to help them out.
Do you think people are willing to pay for this management?
Yeah, you know, I've met people who are really gung-ho about it, and they do feel really passionate about it, and they, you know, they can take on that fiscal or financial responsibility and things like that. But luckily, there are also a lot of, you know, cost-share programs that people can apply to. I'm sure you guys are familiar with the NRCS EQIP program and things like that. The New York State DEC has the Regenerate New York program. So that's something that we also help out with, is, you know, helping landowners find those cost-share programs and see if they qualify for them too, because those are really great because this stuff can be expensive.
You may not know the answer to this or not, but has Audubon changed, or have you heard of changes like in the culture there when it pertains to like cutting practices in the last 5, 10, 20, 30 years from maybe people older than you or anything like that?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I am fairly new to Audubon. I've been here a little over 6 months, but from what I understand is the culture has changed a little bit. We're currently redoing our strategic plan, which kind of drives all of our work for the next 5 years or so. And we're really, you know, now realizing there's all of this research surrounding management and its benefits. And I think that's really allowing us to focus on that on the ground conservation and implementing those practices. So I think it's definitely changing. And, you know, there are a lot of people who still think that Audubon, you know, maybe doesn't want to manage or wouldn't recommend that, but that's not really the case. It is something that we definitely recommend and are working on implementing.
Do you think that was the case, like, back in the day, or was it, or is that just a false, like, kind of perception?
You know, it can be a little bit of a mix. Like I said, I'm fairly new, but I think probably there was a little bit of that, you know, anti-cutting trees type thing. And Audubon's also an interesting organization because, you know, we have the National Audubon Society, which Audubon New York is the state office of. And then we also have local chapters who are kind of their own entity, but they support national. And sometimes they kind of have their own goals and things like that. So there can be a little bit of a disconnect.
Yeah, because, you know, sometimes I'm talking to members and I tell them, you know, actually Audubon, you know, sometimes often supports forest management and cutting, and they're shocked. Hey, so that perception's still there. They're like, oh, really? And then, you know, you go into why. But
yeah, it's the habitat question. Comes back to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is forest management with birds in mind with Audubon New York's Claire Mann. So what's the issue, Claire? Why all the hubbub surrounding getting involved with habitat management for the birds? What's the deal?
Yeah, that's a great question. The big issue is really that forest birds, so birds that are using our forests for their breeding habitat, are in decline. There's been a lot of research surrounding this, but really what they've discovered is that over the last 50 years or so, we've lost almost 3 billion birds. And that's a net loss. So they looked at increases and decreases over that time. So a net loss of almost 3 billion birds, which really equates to almost 30% of the population. So pretty staggering number.
Yeah, that's really staggering. Because it kind of, as someone who also is in conservation, it's not good for us. Yeah. If you know what I mean, the last 50 years, you know, and we've lost that much. I mean, man, what can we do?
What major bird species have we lost? I mean, what was the main cause of these numbers?
Yeah, so you know, the biggest thing really is a loss of habitat. So, and, you know, here we'll talk about eastern forest birds, so a loss of forest. And then just a general loss of habitat quality as well, which, you know, could be a variety of things, you know, from forest fragmentation, large forest blocks that are being broken up by different types of land use, like residential land use or agricultural land use, to things like invasive plant species, deer overabundance, you know, deer browse on native plants that are, you know, good food sources for birds, as well as limit regeneration. And then a big thing is actually forests that all look the same, you know, they're all the same age class or not a high diversity of species. Diversity in a forest is really important for birds. They need different age classes and a lot of different species to be successful and to support, you know, a wide array of birds. So,
so if birds were, like, more plentiful 60 years ago, I mean, what was, I mean, there was, what was going on then? It's just, it seems to me the forest is just younger. I mean, is that good for a lot of ground nesting birds? Like, you know, I'm not a, not an expert in birds, so what's the deal? I mean, is it, and when we say forest fragmentation or quality, I mean, I feel like to someone who is not involved in forestry, they just think of like Walmart's going up, but is it really that simple? I don't know.
You know, it's probably not that simple. There are, you know, a ton of factors at play. But I would say that, you know, the forest fragmentation and loss of overall numbers, acreage of forests is really the biggest thing. And it's really all about trying to take what we have left and keeping it on the landscape and improving it to be better for birds.
So this isn't like species loss or anything. This is just kind of a drop in the total number of birds that migrate along the flyway.
Yeah, so, you know, we have lost just generally the total number of birds, but there are species who are affected at higher rates than others. You know, an example that we really lift up in New York is the wood thrush, which the wood thrush is down about 60%, or six out of every wood thrush has been lost in the landscape since 1970. There's other species like cerulean warbler that are even closer to like 75%. And then, you know, the American woodcock, ruff grouse, those are both species that are in decline, and a lot of work is focused on them. And we do focus a lot of our work on those species that are in those heavier declines. And if we're helping them, we'll also be helping a lot of other species at the same time, which is good.
So what kind of habitats are these birds found in? What are we losing in terms of where they're seen?
So wood thrush, for example, is found in mature forests, but they have pretty specific habitat needs. They are a mid-story nester, so they like to build their nest, say, 30 feet off the ground, but they do their foraging at ground level. They like a lot of leaf litter, and they go through and flip around the leaves to catch insects and things like that. So for them, an important thing is the structure within your forest and having a good, robust mid-story for them to be able to build their nests in, which can be challenging, you know, when we're seeing issues with forest regeneration and that next cohort of trees coming in to fill in your mid-story. And then an interesting thing about a lot of the species in our area is that even if they're a mature forest nester like the wood thrush, they actually also need young forests on the landscape as well, because after the young leave their nest, or what we call post-fledging, they often move to an area of young forest to find cover and forage for food. So it's important that they have a lot of diversity on the landscape, and I think that's really what we're lacking in our forest.
Yeah, that's what I think we're lacking the most. I mean, I feel like that's what's most changed in the last 60 years is younger forest, for sure. I mean, in the Catskills here, we have such mature forest compared to the rest of the state. And a lot of those birds you mentioned are probably in decline. We kind of foreshadow what the rest of the state, because we're, you know, our farms were abandoned much earlier than other people. We have the forest preserve, you know, and we have a lot of hardwood stands too, you know, not just like spruce and fir and hemlock. You know, there's a lot of maple and oak and stuff. But yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
So what else? What else? Any other things that are you know, challenging to the habitat? Interfering vegetation? What kind of interfering vegetation comes to mind?
So, invasive species is the big one. And, you know, a lot of people might think that maybe invasive species aren't necessarily bad for birds. You know, a lot of invasive species produce seeds and they produce berries. But what research has found is that those invasive plants, the fruits and berries and seeds and everything like that, are not as nutritious for birds as our native species, which is pretty interesting. And then our native species of, you know, herbaceous plants and shrubs also support a higher diversity and overall number of insect species, which are particularly important to birds during the breeding season because that's kind of their primary diet and that's what they feed their young while they're in their nest. So it's really important for them to have that food source readily available. And then you also have native species that can be considered interfering vegetation. I'm sure you guys have dealt with, you know, American beech after beech bark disease comes in and kills the mature beech, and then it root sprouts and it can really take over an understory and it can kind of outcompete everything else and displace other native plants that we want to have and just reduce that overall diversity in the understory and midstory.
Hmm. So what kind of management techniques would you recommend for certain types of bird species? What kind of cutting, treatment of this vegetation? What do you guys promote?
You know, there's kind of, I'm sure you guys are very familiar, there's really kind of two different schools of thought with forest management, right? There's a lot of even-aged forest management, and then there's uneven-aged forest management. Many times for birds and a lot of other wildlife, uneven-aged forest management really helps us get to that structural diversity that we're looking for within a stand. So it can be really variable what you decide to do. You know, if there's a certain species that you want to target or, you know, a different one, you can kind of tweak it. But the big thing is creating that, what we call vertical structural diversity in the stand, which refers to multiple layers of vegetation. So an overstory, a midstory, and an understory. And a lot of times, that's going to be created through canopy gaps and allowing more light to reach the forest floor. So that could look like a variable density thinning, or you could do patch cuts where you do, you know, an acre or two where you take every tree and do those kind of scattered throughout a stand. And that, you know, really just helps kind of promote that structural diversity in a stand. But, you know, if you're going to do those canopy gaps and opening up, you do have to treat things like your invasive species or interfering vegetation first before you open that up, or else that's probably all you're going to get back.
Yeah, and also how do you challenge, you know, if you make a small opening, like with uneven age, single tree or group selection or something, how do you deal with deer? I mean, when you're only making such a small opening, you're never going to overwhelm them, at least in our neck of the woods.
Yes, deer are a huge challenge. I'm sure you guys are very familiar. Unfortunately, things that are really effective, like deer fencing or slash walls, are cost prohibitive. And, you know, if you're doing, like you said, group openings or patch cuts that are small, you're probably not even going to produce enough slash for a slash wall. Right. So kind of the next best thing is really to just scatter your slash in any cold wood that you're not using throughout this, you know, the opening, to ideally impede deer the best you can, which it works sometimes, but it certainly doesn't work all the time.
What about, I mean, New York, this is not really practice, but is Audubon thinking about prescribed fire at all?
You know, I don't think, like, we particularly have the capacity to do that, but there is a lot of, you know, really interesting work and studies done on that. I was pretty involved in the prescribed burning program when I worked on the Allegheny National Forest, which is just in Pennsylvania.
Sure.
And that can definitely be helpful for regeneration and things like that.
I mean, probably some people that I believe, I mean, I feel like most of the eastern United States was probably burned at one point. Different fire return levels on different areas. I mean, that had to have impacted wildlife for a very long time. I mean, I might argue this is the first time in the last 150 years that we're not burning as much.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, fire is a type of disturbance, and that's basically what we're trying to mimic with a lot of this management, because, you know, we've spent so much time trying to reduce disturbance on the landscape for, you know, our sake. You know, we don't want to have wildfires burning everything all the time. But that disturbance is important to wildlife, so we can kind of mimic it through management.
I think we need to be a bigger disturbance as humans and go beyond mimicking natural. The natural's not doing good enough. I'm going to say it right now. It's not. I'll show you where it's not doing good enough in the Catskills. We need to do more. It's just there's just not enough light. These forests are so dense. I don't see how any birds survive. I mean, there's nothing to eat out there.
Yeah.
I don't know. My opinion. Zane?
Yeah, well, I think it comes back to that, what is the type of management people are willing to pay for.
Yeah.
And if putting up fences and slash walls is prohibitive, then something else, something cheaper, might have to be used. So in terms of your on-the-ground conservation, are there, like, success stories out there that you had a hand in or your colleagues had a hand in that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I think, you know, we do a lot of really great work throughout the state. And, you know, in New York, we partner with our neighboring states. Like, we do a lot of work in conjunction with Vermont and Pennsylvania and Connecticut. But I think, really, I just want to highlight, you know, there's a lot of landowners that we've worked with that have done management that they probably would have never done if we didn't come out and do some sort of site visit, because they didn't know that birds need these different band characteristics. They thought that just leaving their forest alone was going to be the best thing for birds. So us just getting out there and telling people and educating people has been a huge success. And then we have some other programs that, you know, really kind of work in conjunction with this and help us get more work out there. Like our Bird Friendly Maple program, which is a really great program where we offer endorsements to maple syrup producers if they agree to manage their sugar bush for bird habitat. And that's in New York, we have 20 producers and almost 3,000 acres of land has been, you know, enrolled in that program. And that program's growing really quickly. So I expect that number to just keep getting bigger and bigger, which is exciting.
What does a sugar bush look like that's bird friendly?
Yeah, so it's kind of some of those same things that I've talked about. That vertical structural diversity is the big thing. A lot of bands, when you're making maple syrup, you kind of go into, right, and they might be only sugar maple, and they might be kind of cleared out. Because if you make maple syrup, you're familiar with the fact that, you know, you might have to put up buckets or a tubing system. And it's kind of a pain if there's a bunch of stuff in the way. So people kind of clear it out, not always. But to make it more bird friendly, we want to increase, you know, stuff in the understory, stuff in the midstory. And the other interesting thing is that we want to kind of move away from having a monoculture of sugar maple. So we want to see some species diversity within that stand. Our recommendation is to have about 25% of your stand a species other than sugar maple. And that number comes from some research that's been done that shows that overall bird diversity and abundance goes down as a stand transitions more to a monoculture of sugar maple. And so that 25% is really that sweet spot of where you start seeing more birds, but you're still allowing your producer to have a lot of sugar maple to make maple syrup with.
Do you ever think diversity is overrated with some trees, like oak?
You know, it depends, you know, and it depends on, from a wildlife and a bird standpoint, what you are managing for, because there are a lot of bird species who have really strong associations with particular tree species.
Right.
So from our standpoint, I think there's just about any native tree where we could be like, oh, this bird loves that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, just curious.
How do I manage for more raptors and predatory birds to attack the squirrels gnawing at my
there you go.
Tubing?
You sick person.
Yeah, that's a good question. Raptors often build their nest in a large tree. For example, the red-shouldered hawk will almost exclusively build its nest in a deciduous tree in kind of the crook of a large branch and the bole of the tree. So they need big trees. So we have some recommendations on sizes of what a large tree is for us. And for hardwoods, we like to see stuff that's like 24 inches diameter, you know, DBH, and then softwoods more like 20 inches.
Yeah.
But if you have those, and those can help attract things like raptors and owls, then need those bigger trees to build their nest.
How high up in the tree are these cavities usually? How high do they go?
So I would say most are really kind of in the upper portion of the tree, a lot of times 50 feet and up off the ground.
Okay.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Every Wednesday, tonight's topic is forest management with birds in mind, with Audubon New York's Claire Mann. Claire, we're going to take a break, but we got some more questions for Claire, more about the nitty-gritty of doing some habitat management, maybe on your forest to improve it for birds, up next.
Okay.
Just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is forest management with birds in mind with Audubon New York's Claire Mann. Claire, so when you're walking in the woods looking for bird habitat, what's a tree or shrub that you're like, man, I'd like to see some more of that?
Yeah? That's a good question. Oh. I think, you know, for the most part, really just anytime I see native species, especially in the midstory and understory, like shrubs and things like that, that we are more and more seeing that they're being outcompeted by invasive. So when I see things like a service berry or a spice bush that I know that a lot of birds love and get a lot of great food from, I'm always really excited about those.
What about like a Norway spruce?
Oh. That's a good question. You know, I like seeing those too. Birds have, there are a lot of species who really like soft wood. And even when you only have like a small cluster of softwoods in your stand, whether it's something like a spruce or a hemlock, that's a really good habitat for birds. There are species that is their preferred nesting site. And if they don't find it, they're going to have to look somewhere else. So we do love that as well.
Do they like it for the cover? Or do they actually like the seeds and go after those? Or is that just a squirrel thing?
They do both. So sometimes they are kind of seeking it out for the cover, for a site to build their nest. But then often they're also eating the seeds and sometimes even the fresh buds.
Hmm. Yeah. So, but no, like, you know, native shrub that produces a lot of mass that is you know, something that maybe we should perpetuate more of in particular?
I wouldn't say anything in particular, especially because it's so variable throughout the state and your different sites, but anytime you can pick a native shrub or herbaceous plant, we're all about it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we have a lot of shrubs growing as autumn olive in here, and I mean, I don't know. I question whether... I realize they might not have as much nutrition, but, you know, if you're starving and you only have Gatorade out there, Gatorade something.
You're not wrong.
Nothing, it's not killing off anything. It's just that there's really nothing going to grow except for stilt grass or some other plant that is deer resistant. I mean, that's just where we're at in our part of the state. It's a challenge.
You're right, and sometimes you kind of have to pick, like, the best worst-case scenario, right?
Yeah.
I know John did some kind of research for an article he wrote, and he was surprised to find how nutritious or seemingly nutritious rose hips are on multi-floor rows.
Oh, you had to say that, didn't you, Zane? You're really bringing them out now.
I mean, these are complex systems, and a lot of things are going on, but I don't know if you've...
Yeah, it's hard when we make... you know, really broad generalizations. Of course, that's not going to cover every instance of everything all the time. So,
yeah. Let's see. So, coarse woody debris. Your thoughts?
Yeah. So, coarse woody material, or, you know, we often refer to it as down woody material, is really just logs and sticks on the ground, right? That can be really beneficial for nutrient cycling in your forest, but it's also really great for birds. It provides habitat for forage, places to nest and to seek cover. There's even species like the ruffed grouse is one that really needs large logs on the ground, like 18 inches in diameter. because that's where they do their drumming displays, which, if you're not familiar, is when they get up on top of the log and they flap their wings really fast, and it kind of creates a vacuum and makes this loud noise that they use for attracting mates, as well as kind of defending their territory from other male grouse. And it's really awesome if you're in the woods and you get to hear it. It can sound like a chainsaw starting off in the distance or something like that. So they're really particular about that. So that's one way that you can kind of provide some habitat for them.
When you talked about people never considered managing their woods or changing their forest dynamics to serve birds, seeing a lot of dead trees in the ground, that can be like shocking for people. They associate that with an unhealthy condition.
Like a bomb went off.
Yeah.
Right? Is that something you hear a lot? It looks like a bomb went off here. Oh, this is great.
For sure. Kind of getting people away from that idea of like a manicured forest is a healthy forest. You know, sometimes you look at it and you're like, aesthetically, that looks pretty nice. But once you really start thinking about all of the different, you know, wildlife and all the different interactions, you start to realize how important it is to provide all of these different things at the same time. But, you know, it can be a little shocking at first if they use some more of that clean understory.
Do you walk with landowners like that? You know, you're like, no, this is not a bomb. This is a good thing. This is great. This is so much woody material down. How do you sell that?
You know, I really just try to, like, hit home with those examples of, like, this bird uses that. And that gets a lot of landowners thinking about it and saying, okay. And, you know, you can also tailor it to what their goals for their property are. You know, if you have a landowner who's really into recreation and has a lot of trails through their forest, they can still have trails. They don't have to have logs down across their trails. They can just kind of have them, you know, throughout. It doesn't necessarily have to be evenly spread through the whole stand. And that kind of helps people to say, oh, okay, I can still do what I want to do here while providing habitat.
Alternatively, do you girdle large trees? Have dead standing trees a lot?
You know, that is something that we recommend for landowners who don't have a lot of snags, because snags are great for birds as well. Again, provides areas for them to forage and nest, and then will eventually become down woody material when they fall over. And sometimes landowners, especially, you'll find that landowner who does, a lot of firewood cutting, and they're really on top of cutting unhealthy trees, and then they don't have anything to turn into snags, so landowners can girdle trees to create snags.
Did you have, I know you're in Western New York, have you heard anything about the Catskills and any kind of significance, you know, about birds and bird habitat compared to other regions or states?
Yeah, so the Catskills are a great location for birds. We actually at Audubon have identified the Catskills as one of our priority forest areas, which are just large contiguous blocks of forest that support a lot of bird species, especially those species that are in decline. And the thing that the Catskills really have going for them is they're a very large forested area. And a lot of these birds need large blocks of forest, or else they don't really want to hang out there. So the Catskills are great for that, and they are kind of right in the middle of that, you know, the migration path. So they're really, really important habitat for birds.
Here's a challenge as a forester. How do you balance getting regeneration with having a midstory? This is something that I ponder at night.
Yes, that can definitely be challenging, right? Because eventually your midstory can start to shade out anything that's growing in your understory.
I'm thinking black birch in the midstory underneath a high-graded red maple stand. Have you seen that anywhere in New York State?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. All right, great. Go from there.
But, you know, I guess from a bird perspective, yes, we want trees in the understory too, like those are generating trees, but we can also have shrubs and herbaceous plants that are a little bit more shade tolerant, because that's where they're have evolved to grow. And that's really the biggest thing, is kind of managing four species of varying shade tolerance within what you're able to do on that specific site. You know, sometimes you don't have the right growing conditions, but if you can try to manage for that diversity of species, hopefully you can kind of get stuff to persist long enough till your next treatment, where, you know, you can come in and, you know, maybe open up the canopy again or do some sort of crop tree release and things like that.
Now, yeah. Now, what do you think about if regeneration is taken out of the picture for a second, right? I mean, does mere coarse woody material on the ground, the structure it creates, is that good for birds in itself, in your opinion?
Yes and no.
Damn.
There are, you know, some species who would be okay with that, and then there's others who are not. You know, some, I gave the example of the wood thrush earlier, they kind of interact with the understory searching for insects, but they're like right on the ground.
Yeah.
And then there are other species who interact with the understory because that's where they build their nest, and they are very particular about wanting to build their nest in really dense shrubs and things like that. And they forage flying around and catching insects off the plants and shrubs. So they need that structure. So yes and no, like you're going to provide some for some birds and not for other birds, but that's, I mean, in reality going to be the case in most forests, right?
I guess, would you say it's an overall positive compared to, say, the adjacent area that has a fern understory with mostly red maple overstory? Would it be, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you could say that.
Yeah, it's just that, just think like a homogenous canopy stratum of red maple, 50 feet tall to 70 feet, with just fern in the bottom, on the forest
yeah.
floor.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. These are the things we struggle with because, you know, we're not always going to be able to convince landowners to use herbicides and get rid of some of those interfering species growing on the forest floor right. before doing that nice cut. So, you know, sometimes just tell landowners, hey, at least there's some structure on the ground. You had nothing before.
All right.
But, yeah. but you know, that's something I believe in, but I don't, you know, I haven't done a huge amount of research to show them studies wise, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, that does make sense, especially in an area where you're going to have a hard time doing the alternative, like you said, motivating a landowner to use herbicide and really control that interfering vegetation. So again, sometimes you do the best you can with ability you have.
We've got about four more minutes left. I always like to ask this, but you know, how would you define conservation?
You know, to me, conservation is protecting nature in a way that you're protecting it so that you can use the resources responsibly. You know, we want to be able to provide, you know, quality timber products, protect our water quality while recreating in forests and hunting. And we want that now, but we also want to make sure that we provide that for people in the future as well. So it's responsible management of our forest products.
Hmm. And how do you think it differs from like preservation?
To me, preservation is more of like, we're going to keep nature as it is, more of a hands-off approach. I kind of think of nature or preservation more like a wilderness area where you're not allowed to do management and things like that.
Yeah.
So more just kind of that hands-off approach.
Yeah, I feel like that's the challenge between, like, you know, our organization, the Catskill Forest Association and Audubon are faced with in New York State is I just don't think many people know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's very true. A lot of, you know, landowners I work with think that hands-off approach is the best way, but we have so many external factors playing into, you know, forest insects and diseases, invasive species, deer browsing, that all fighting against our ability to not be involved. We have to do something.
Yeah, and you also wonder how many of those things came before the lack of conservation, or you know, what, or because of because of our lack of conservation. Who knows? Or maybe both. You know, I don't know.
Right.
Some of it's because of maybe trade or whatever, global trade. But man. you just wonder. I don't know. These are big picture things that are beyond me. What do you think, Zane?
Yeah, I think the trends, these long-term trends, is what you look at as being kind of the ultimate causes for these things, but they may not be, you know, things that would help us today. But I think land use, talking about land use more, talking about habitat more, is all to the good.
So, Claire, what's next? What's your next endeavor?
You know,
what are you looking forward to, I guess?
I've got a great, you know, summer schedule coming up with a lot of programs with both, you know, forestry professionals and landowners that I'm really excited about. A lot of work in the Adirondacks. We're hoping to secure some grant funding to keep doing some more work down in the Catskills. I really enjoy working my bird-friendly maple program, and any time I get to go out in the woods and meet with landowners, it's a good day.
Well, please keep fire in mind. We're trying to research ourselves. We took the S-130, S-190. We'd like to see a little more fire and see how that plays into it, alongside cutting with the chainsaw and herbicides as another tool. We'll see where that goes. But we really appreciate your time coming on. Where can people go to access your programs or get an on-site consultation, right, which you offer?
Yeah, they go to Audubon New York's website, which is just ny.audubon.org. They can find information about all of our programs, and they can find my information and contact me about site visits and things like that.
Cool. Well, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, have a good night.
You too. Bye.
If you just missed the show, that was Claire Mann from the Audubon, New York, talking about forest management with birds in mind, and have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. His castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd end up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year. Flowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river